Not one has proved out. No investment strategy or tactic will ever deliver a high return without risk, especially to buyers lacking a high level of investing skill. Outstanding investment results can only come from exceptional skill, or perhaps in isolated moments from good luck. As I said earlier, bubbles generally spring from a grain of truth. But they're all taken too far, and their eventual puncturing brings the greatest pain in the investment world. Belief in a silver bullet underlies many bubbles. The fact that investors are willing to swallow a promise of return without risk is an infallible indicator that skepticism is in short supply, psychology is overheated, and the subject asset is overestimated, and thus probably overpriced. Watch out for it, and resist if you can. By definition, when it comes to bubbles, few people do. I would sum up the key conclusion this way. The subprime mortgage bubble arose from broad acceptance that phenomena would work that had never before been seen in action. The analysis of investment vehicles should entail A, the application of skepticism and conservative assumptions, and B, examination over a long history that includes some trying times. These things were clearly missing. In fact, most bubbles, if not all, are characterized by the unquestioning acceptance of things that have never held true in the past, of valuations that are dramatically out of line with historic norms, and/or of investment techniques and tools that haven't been tested. The subprime mortgage bubble demonstrated an extremely important principle in action that I haven't touched upon before now. The financial and investment environment and the performance of investment techniques and instruments is not immutable. Rather, as I've said many times with regard to cycles, these things are affected by the involvement of people. There is no such thing as a market that is separate from, and unaffected by, the people who make it up. The behavior of the people in the market changes the market. When their attitudes and behavior change, the market will change. In the case at hand, market forces changed the participants' motivations, as just described. These changed motivations changed their behavior, and their changed behavior clearly determined the results. An essential progression was at work, as is clear to see. History was taken as saying there couldn't be a nationwide wave of mortgage defaults. Acceptance of this benign history caused vast sums to be invested in mortgage-backed securities. It permitted the securities to be structured aggressively. It also caused rating agencies to extrapolate the benign experience and grant high ratings. Most importantly, the strong demand for mortgage-backed securities created a need for the raw material, mortgage loans, and led to an eagerness to issue them that caused lending standards to deteriorate. These developments, taken together, virtually guaranteed that there would be a nationwide wave of mortgage defaults. As I mentioned earlier, because of the impact of careless lending practices, the import of which went largely unnoticed and unremarked at the time, the default experience on mortgages issued from the late 1990s through 2007 turned out to be much worse than it historically had been, worse than the security structurers and rating agencies had thought possible, and worse than buyers' models had said it would be. Ignoring this possibility made a significant contribution to the creation of the subprime mortgage bubble. Its occurrence caused the resulting crisis. The key is to understand that the behavior of investors can alter the market, changing the results that investors can expect the market to deliver. This reflects George Soros's theory of reflexivity. In situations that have thinking participants, the participants' distorted views can influence the situation to which they relate because false views lead to inappropriate actions. Soros, General Theory of Reflexivity, Financial Times, October 26, 2009. People trying to understand how things work in the economic and financial worlds should take this lesson very much to heart. All it takes for the perpetual motion machine to grind to a halt is the failure of one or two assumptions and the operation of some general rules. Interest rates can go up as well as down. Platitudes can fail to hold. Improper incentives can lead to destructive behavior. Attempts to quantify risk in advance, particularly as to novel financial products, for which there is no history, will often be unavailing. The worst case can indeed be exceeded on the downside. The error in all these things is always clear in hindsight. But the risky practices with regard to mortgages and mortgage-backed securities, which became so prominent and important, were taking place in an obscure corner of the financial world. Thus, they were invisible to chief investment officers, portfolio strategists, equity investors, alternative investment managers, traditional bond buyers, and seemingly even mortgage investors. We at Oaktree were fortunate in the years in which the mortgage bubble arose, leading up to the global financial crisis, to understand that the credit cycle was becoming extended in the upward direction, and thus that the markets were increasingly precarious. This led us to sell assets, replace large liquidating distressed debt funds with smaller ones, increase our level of risk consciousness and conservatism, and raise a standby fund, several times our largest ever, in order to take advantage of the distressed debt opportunities we felt might materialize. What was the basis on which we did this? In retrospect, it was easy, although it never seems as easy in real time. All you really had to do in 2005 to 07 was make the following general observations. The Fed had reduced the base rate of interest to very low levels in order to ward off the depressing effects of the tech bubble's bursting, as well as concern over Y2K. Because of the low yields available on treasuries and high-grade bonds, as well as the disenchantment with equities that had resulted from their three-year decline in 2000 to 02, investors were eager to put money into alternative instruments. Investors had shrugged off the pain of the collapse of the tech bubble in 2000 and the telecom meltdown and corporate scandals of 2001 to 02. Thus, little risk aversion was present, especially in areas other than equities, which remained out of favor, rendering investors generally eager for investments in exotic, structured, and synthetic instruments. And as a result of all the above, the markets were wide open for the issuance of low-quality debt, poorly structured instruments, and untested alternatives. These were our observations, and it was the last that most called our attention to the negative trends that were afoot. It felt like there wasn't a day on which either Bruce, Karsh, or I didn't visit each other's office to complain about a newly issued security, saying, "It shouldn't be possible to issue a piece of junk like this. The fact that it is means there's something wrong with the market." Those risky deals told us fear, skepticism, and risk aversion were insufficient, and greed, gullibility, and risk tolerance were in the ascendancy. The implications of this combination are never good. All the points noted here were obvious and not subject to debate. All that mattered is whether you made these observations and drew the appropriate conclusions. You didn't have to fully understand what was wrong with subprime mortgages or deconstruct mortgage-backed securities and highly structured collateralized debt obligations. We certainly didn't. And by the way, in those years when the mortgage bubble was building, stocks weren't doing well or selling at lofty multiples, and the economy wasn't booming and thus necessarily heading for a recession. But if you made the observations just listed, you likely would have concluded, as we did, that it was time to reduce the quantum of risk in your portfolio. That's really all it took. And here are the results of the bursting of the mortgage bubble and the associated contagion, as shown in the performance of some of the standard investment indices in 2008, the year it all came apart. Clearly, it was a year in which it was enormously important to have reduced risk. Standard & Poor's 500 stocks, down 37%. Dow Jones Industrial Average, down 31.9%. NASDAQ Composite, down 40%. MSCI Europe, Australasia, Far East stocks, down 45.1%. Citigroup High Yield Market Index, down 25.9%. Merrill Lynch Global High Yield European Issuer Index, in euro, down 32.6%. Credit Suisse Leveraged Loan Index, down 28.8%. Credit Suisse Western European Loan Index, in euro, down 30.2%. Finally, in discussing how to detect and respond to market cycle extremes, I want to return once more to the widespread panic that followed the bankruptcy filing by Lehman Brothers in September 2008. Although the subprime mortgage crisis originated in a small corner of the financial and investment world, the impact was soon felt widely, particularly by the financial institutions that had underestimated the risk in mortgage-backed securities and thus invested too heavily in them. As a result of the threat to these essential institutions, the impact metastasized to the stock and bond markets in all countries, and then to economies all around the world, in the form of the global financial crisis. Thus, as I described earlier, money market funds and commercial paper had to be guaranteed by the U.S. government. A number of prominent banks and financial institutions failed, or had to be bailed out, rescued, absorbed. No one knew how far the carnage would spread. The equity and debt markets collapsed. Now the generalizing was on the negative side. The financial system could totally melt down, in a vicious circle without end. Since the generalizations were on the downside, the error-making machine went into reverse. No greed, only fear. No optimism, only pessimism. No risk tolerance, only risk aversion. No ability to see positives, only negatives. No willingness to interpret things positively, only negatively. No ability to imagine good outcomes, only bad. Thus, we reached the day in which the pension fund head was unable or unwilling to accept that any assumption regarding possible defaults could be conservative enough. What was the essential observation? Here's what I wrote in The Limits to Negativism, October 2008. Contrarianism, doing the opposite of what others do, or leaning against the wind, is essential for investment success. But as the credit crisis reached a peak last week, people succumbed to the wind rather than resisting. I found very few who were optimistic. Most were pessimistic to some degree. Some became genuinely depressed. Even a few great investors I know. Increasingly negative tales of the coming meltdown were exchanged via email. No one applied skepticism or said, "That horror story's unlikely to be true." Pessimism fed on itself. People's only concern was bulletproofing their portfolios to get through the coming collapse, or raising enough cash to meet redemptions. The one thing they weren't doing last week was making aggressive bids for securities. So prices fell and fell, several points at a time. The old expression is gapped down. The key, as usual, was to become skeptical of what everyone was saying and doing. One might have said, "Sure, the negative story may turn out to be true, but certainly it's priced into the market, so there's little to be gained from betting on it." On the other hand, if it turns out not to be true, the appreciation from today's depressed levels will be enormous. I buy. The negative story may have looked compelling, but it's the positive story, which few believed, that held, and still holds, the greater potential for profit. At this market cycle extreme, all the news truly was negative, and certainly not imaginary. The only questions I received were, how far will it go, and what will be the effects? Given that asset prices reflected nothing but abject pessimism regarding these things, I'd say near suicidal thinking, the key to profiting lay in recognizing that even in the face of uniformly bad news and a very poor outlook, pessimism can be overdone, and thus assets can become too cheap. It was the excessiveness of the prevailing pessimism that led me to write The Limits to Negativism at the credit market's low ebb in October 2008. In it, I pointed out, as mentioned in the chapter on attitudes toward risk, that the superior investor's essential skepticism calls for pessimism when optimism is excessive, but it also calls for optimism when pessimism is excessive. That variety of skepticism was totally lacking in the market's darkest days, of course. Shortly after Lehman's bankruptcy filing on September 15, 2008, Bruce Karsh and I reached the conclusion that A, no one could know how far the financial institution meltdown would go, but B, negativity was certainly rampant and very possibly excessive, and assets looked terribly cheap. Thinking strategically, we decided that if the financial world ended, which no one could rule out, it wouldn't matter whether we'd bought or not. But if the world didn't end, and we hadn't bought, we would have failed to do our job. So we bought debt aggressively. Oaktree invested more than $500 million a week, over the 15 weeks from September 15th through the end of the year. Some days we thought we were going too fast, and some days too slow. That probably meant we had it about right. The world didn't end. The vicious cycle of financial institution implosion stopped with Lehman Brothers. The capital markets reopened. The financial institutions came back to life. Debt was again able to be refinanced. Bankruptcies turned out to be very few, relative to history. And the assets we bought appreciated substantially. In short, paying heed to the cycle was rewarded. While we're reviewing the climate in late 2008, this is an appropriate time for a discussion of investor behavior on the way to and at market bottoms. First, what is a bottom? It's the point when the lowest prices of the cycle are reached. Thus, a bottom can be viewed as the day the last panicked holder sells, or the last day on which sellers predominate relative to buyers. For whatever reason, it's the last day prices go down, and thus, the day they reach their nadir. Of course, these definitions are highly exaggerated. The expression, a bottom, like a top, describes a period of time, not a day. Thus, the phrase, the last day, is mostly a figure of speech. From the bottom, prices rise, since there are no holders left to capitulate and sell, or because the buyers now want to buy more strongly than the sellers want to sell. The question I want to touch on here is, when should one begin to buy? I made reference in earlier chapters to falling knives, which constitute a very important concept. When a market is cascading downward, investors can often be heard to say, "We're not going to try to catch a falling knife." In other words, the trend is downward, and there's no way to know when it'll stop. So why should we buy before we're sure the bottom has been reached? What I think they're really saying is, we're scared, in particular of buying before the decline has stopped, and thus of looking bad, so we're going to wait until the bottom has been reached, the dust has settled, and the uncertainty has been resolved. But hopefully by now I've made it abundantly clear that when the dust has settled and investors' nerves have steadied, the bargains will be gone. At Oaktree, we strongly reject the idea of waiting for the bottom to start buying. First, there's absolutely no way to know when the bottom has been reached. There's no neon sign that lights up. The bottom can be recognized only after it has been passed, since it is defined as the day before the recovery begins. By definition, this can be identified only after the fact. And second, it's usually during market slides that you can buy the largest quantities of the thing you want, from sellers who are throwing in the towel, and while the non-knife catchers are hugging the sidelines. But once the slide has culminated in a bottom, by definition, there are few sellers left to sell, and during the ensuing rally, it's buyers who predominate. Thus, the selling dries up, and would-be buyers face growing competition. We began to buy distressed debt immediately after Lehman filed for bankruptcy protection in mid-September 2008, and we continued through year-end as prices went lower and lower. By the first quarter of 2009, other investors had collected themselves, caught on to the values that were available, and gathered some capital for investment. But with the motivated sellers done selling and buying having begun, it was too late for them to buy in size without pushing up prices. Like so many other things in the investment world that might be tried on the basis of certitude and precision, waiting for the bottom to start buying is a great example of folly. So, if targeting the bottom is wrong, when should you buy? The answer's simple. When price is below intrinsic value. What if the price continues downward? Buy more, as now it's probably an even greater bargain. All you need for ultimate success in this regard is A, an estimate of intrinsic value, B, the emotional fortitude to persevere, and C, eventually to have your estimate of value proved correct. Here's how the prominent investment indices did the following year. The returns that were available in 2009 show the importance of having recognized a cycle at a negative extreme and having bought in, or at least held on through, the accompanying chaos. Standard & Poor's 500 stocks up 26.5%, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 22.7%, NASDAQ Composite up 45.4%, MSCI Europe, Australasia, Far East stocks in U.S. dollars up 27.8%, Citigroup High Yield Market Index up 55.2%, B of A, Merrill Lynch Global High Yield European Issuer Index up 83%, Credit Suisse Leveraged Loan Index up 44.9%, Credit Suisse Western European Loan Index in Euro 47.2%. It's time for another aside. If you look at the last two tables, those showing big losses in 2008 and big gains in 2009, it's easy to conclude that the 2 years together were something of a non-event. For example, if you put $100 into the Credit Suisse Leveraged Loan Index on the first day of 2008, you would have lost 29% over the course of the year and had only $71 left at the end. But then you would have gained 45% in 2009 and ended up with $103 at the conclusion of the 2 year period for a net gain of $3. The 2 year results in the asset classes listed above ranged from moderate net losses to moderate net gains. It matters enormously, however, what you did in between. Yes, holding on would have enabled you to recoup most or all of your losses and end up well with results as described above. But if you lost your nerve and sold at the trough, or if, having bought with borrowed money, you received a margin call you couldn't meet and saw your positions sold out from under you, you experienced the decline but not the recovery, and your net result in this non-event 2 year period was disastrous. For this reason, it's important to note that exiting the market after a decline and thus failing to participate in a cyclical rebound is truly the cardinal sin in investing. Experiencing a mark-to-market loss in the downward phase of a cycle isn't fatal in and of itself, as long as you hold through the beneficial upward part as well. It's converting that downward fluctuation into a permanent loss by selling out at the bottom that's really terrible. Thus, understanding cycles and having the emotional and financial wherewithal needed to live through them is an essential ingredient in investment success. Before I declare victory in the global financial crisis and move on, I want to state firmly that the success my colleagues and I enjoyed in profiting from this cycle wasn't inevitable. That's because, reflecting Elroy Dimson's theme, the good outcome we got wasn't the only outcome that could have materialized. I'm convinced that if Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and Ben Bernanke hadn't acted when they did, or if they had acted differently, or if their actions hadn't been as successful as they were, a financial meltdown and replay of the Great Depression absolutely could have occurred. In that case, our actions wouldn't have been cause for celebration. I fear that people may look back at the decline of 2008 and the recovery that followed and conclude that declines can always be depended on to be recouped promptly and easily, and thus there's nothing to worry about from down cycles. But I think those are the wrong lessons from the crisis, since the outcome that actually occurred was so much better than some of the alternative histories, as Nassim Nicholas Taleb calls them, that could have occurred instead. And if those incorrect lessons are the ones that are learned, as I believe they may have been, then they're likely to bring on behavior that increases the amplitude of another dramatic boom-bust cycle someday, maybe one with more serious and long-lasting ramifications for investors and for all of society. But things did break for us in the recovery from the crisis and for all long investors. Certainly, we positioned our clients' portfolios correctly for the future that materialized, and a lot of it was because of our feeling for the way in which psychological and market cycles operate. Given the inability to predict the future, that's the best anyone can do. Bubbles and crashes have a pattern all their own, a logic or illogic, the essence of which rhymes from one instance to the next. The three episodes reviewed here show the oscillation of the cycle at its most extreme, and hopefully, they provide an indication of how cycles can be recognized and dealt with. I want to make a few last essential points. First, every element in the progressions I've described was clear to see at the time, providing investors could keep their emotions and distorted perception from getting in the way. Second, drawing the essential inferences, and thus taking the appropriate actions, didn't require any forecasting at all. The descriptions of the actual progressions are compelling, with no guesses needed regarding the future. The events and resulting cyclical excesses dictated profitable behavior. Finally, however, while I say the events were self-evident and the implications obvious, I want to state definitively that nothing was easy at the time. Even the best and least emotional among us are subjected to the same inputs and stimuli as everyone else. We were never sure, but we did the right thing nevertheless. And while the errors leading up to the global financial crisis were easily recognizable, the timing of their correcting was absolutely beyond predicting. The best investors can do is act in light of what they see in the environment. But they must bear in mind what John Maynard Keynes is reputed to have said, "The markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent." To close on the subject of dealing with cyclical events, I want to provide one more example from 1991. Leveraged buyouts had boomed in the 1980s, thanks to the ability of buyers of companies to access significant amounts of debt capital, often ranging up to 95% of the total purchase price. This led to many of the subject companies being saddled with debt they wouldn't be able to service in the recession that followed, to large numbers of defaults and bankruptcies, and thus to high-yield bonds' first crisis. These developments came to a head just after we formed our funds 2 and 2B for distressed debt. Here's how I assessed the environment in a letter to their investors, on January 23, 1991. In general, the market prices of distressed company debt declined during 1990. Some of this was driven by fundamentals, as the market value of all assets weakened, along with the economy, and some was due to technical conditions, meaning the supply of this sort of debt ballooned, and buyers were discouraged and withdrew. The worsening economic and psychological climate gives us the opportunity to pick and choose among a large number of prospective investments at bargain prices. The environment is dreary, as much of what one buys is soon quoted lower, and there is no ebullience. These are exactly the conditions under which we want to be working. When buyers are enjoying themselves, and when they are exchanging high fives because everything they buy goes higher the next day and makes them feel smart, the pain index is too low and buyers are emboldened. Today's conditions tell me we are more likely to be getting bargains than if we were having fun. There are few competing bidders to drive up the prices of the things we want to buy. Each purchase price is more likely to turn out to have been a low than a high. In short, This is a good time to be putting money to work in a contrarian investment area such as ours. We cannot presume to begin investing on the day the economy and market hit bottom. Our greatest hope is that the low point will occur sometime during the period when we are actively investing a fund, and that we will buy on the way to, during, and after that moment. This is a good example of taking the temperature of the market in real time, not just because it was me who took it, and not just because it turned out to be right. The distressed debt funds we were investing at that time had some of the highest returns we've ever achieved. Rather, it was good because it detected and pushed back against the depressing emotional influences that were keeping others from buying. It shows we knew the dreary conditions and mark-to-market losses that were driving buyers away were more likely to have favorable rather than unfavorable implications for subsequent returns, and that declining prices are good for buyers, not bad. Understanding what things really mean, rather than how they make investors feel, is the first step toward doing the things that are right for the times. Having allowed this chapter to reach great length, I'm going to end with a general discussion of how to think about positioning a portfolio as the market moves through its cycle. I think it's helpful to take an organized approach to what I call the twin risks. What I'm talking about here is the fact that investors have to deal daily with two possible sources of error. The first is obvious, the risk of losing money. The second is a bit more subtle, the risk of missing opportunity. Investors can eliminate either one, but doing so will expose them entirely to the other. So most people balance the two. What should an investor's normal stance be regarding the two risks? Evenly balanced or favoring one or the other? The answer depends mostly on one's goals, circumstances, personality, and ability to withstand risk, and on the same things with regard to one's clients, if any. And separate and apart from his normal posture, should the investor alter the balance from time to time? And if so, how? I think investors should try to appropriately adjust their stance if they, A, feel they have the requisite insight, and B, are willing to expend effort and bear the risk of being wrong. They should do this based on where the market is in its cycle. In short, when the market is high in its cycle, they should emphasize limiting the potential for losing money. And when the market is low in its cycle, they should emphasize reducing the risk of missing opportunity. How? Try to travel into the future and look back. In 2023, do you think you're more likely to say, "Back in 2018, I wish I'd been more aggressive," or "Back in 2018, I wish I'd been more defensive"? And is there anything today about which you'd be likely to say, "In 2018, I missed the chance of a lifetime to buy XYZ"? What you think you might say a few years down the road can help you figure out what you should do today. The above decisions relate directly to the choice between aggressiveness and defensiveness. When an investor wants to reduce his chance of losing money, he should invest more defensively. More worried about missing opportunity? In that case, increased aggressiveness is called for. Varying one's stance should be done in response to where the market stands in its cycle, and again, this can be approached in terms of how the market is valued and how other investors are behaving, the two elements in assessing the market mentioned earlier. When most investors are behaving aggressively, that's a good signal that the market is a risky place, since little risk aversion is being applied, and investors' aggressiveness is likely to have resulted directly in elevated asset prices. In both ways, as I mentioned earlier, the aggressiveness of others makes the market risky for us. A good way to think about this decision is to consider which attributes are right for the current market environment. In late 2008, early 2009, an investor needed only two things to make a lot of money: money to invest and the nerve to invest it. If he had those two things, he made a lot of money in the years that followed. In retrospect, what he didn't need was caution, conservatism, risk control, discipline, selectivity, and patience. The more of those things he had, the less money he made. Does that mean money and nerve is always a surefire formula for investment success? Absolutely not. If an investor had money and nerve in early 2007, he bore the full brunt of the global financial crisis. That's when he needed caution, conservatism, risk control, discipline, selectivity, and patience. Moreover, even in late 2008, early 2009, intelligent investors couldn't completely abandon caution and discipline because there was no way for them to know that the recovery from the GFC would be so quick and the aftermath so relatively painless for investors. At Oaktree, we invested a lot, but we emphasized the senior debt of high-quality companies, not the junior debt and weaker issuers in which, as it turned out, we would have made even more money. Among the many factors that make investing interesting is the fact that there's no tactic or approach that always works. The only way to try to be correctly positioned as the cycle moves is to make well-reasoned judgments and adjust the attributes employed. But it's not easy. One way people tend to respond to the challenges these days is to ask, "What inning are we in?" Ever since the financial meltdown in late 2008, I've encountered this question on a regular basis. What people really mean by it is, where do we stand in the cycle? In the fourth quarter of 2008, they wondered, how much of the pain has been felt already and how much more lies ahead? More recently, they've been inquiring primarily about the credit cycle. How much longer will it continue on the upswing, making it easier to borrow? And when will credit availability begin to tighten? I consider these questions in the light of my sense for how far things have gone, and I answer in the form the questioners want: second inning, just getting started; fifth inning, game half over; or eighth inning, nearing the end. But recently, I have become more conscious of the limitation of this approach. Unlike a normal baseball game, we have no way to know how long a particular cycle will go on. There is no regulation length. A normal baseball game will last 9 innings, but an economic or market cycle could go 7, 9, 12, or 14. These things are not knowable. None of these approaches offers a foolproof technique for deciding how to position portfolios. They're all just ways to think systematically about something that isn't subject to easy answers. But hopefully, they suggest a route that's superior to deciding on the basis of emotion, guesswork, or just following the herd. How you deal with cycles is one of the most important things in investing. Cycles will happen to you. What you do in response is key. Chapter 14. Cycle Positioning. Successfully positioning a portfolio for the market movements that lie ahead is dependent on what you do, turning aggressive or defensive, and when you do it, based on a superior understanding of what cycles imply for future market moves. I once knew a man who was congenitally optimistic and aggressive, perhaps because he'd had the good sense to be born rich and had led a charmed life. He never exhibited self-doubt or seemed to question the accuracy of his forecasts or the likelihood that his stratagems would succeed. He was aggressive as long as I knew him, in what turned out to be a great time for aggressiveness. That experience inspired me to coin a phrase to describe the forces at work. There are three ingredients for success: aggressiveness, timing, and skill. And if you have enough aggressiveness at the right time, you don't need that much skill. In February 2017, I found myself working on the final chapters of this book while on vacation in India. One day I visited one of the world's great sites, Jaipur's Amer Fort, and attempted to capture a small fraction of its beauty in photos. While reviewing my photos afterwards, I had the good luck to stumble on some I had taken a few months earlier in another exotic location, China. In the course of that visit, a Beijing-based client had asked me a series of provocative questions, and in answering them I made some scribbles, as I often do, on a whiteboard. Answers came to me that day that hadn't crossed my mind before. Recognizing that, I took photos of the board with my iPhone before leaving. What an innovation. 20 years ago, I would never have had a camera at a presentation. 3 months later, while reviewing my photographic handiwork at the Amerfort, I came across those photos from China and thought back to those ideas for the first time. They'll provide much of the grist for this chapter. Now I found myself in bed in India, after a night's sleep cut short by the 10.5-hour time difference from New York. For some reason, a connection dawned between the above saying about success, my photos from Beijing, and the question of how to deal with cycles. In short, I had a thought about how to parse the main components of investment skill. Note that I say, a connection dawned, rather than I made a connection. I consciously choose the passive form here, because I often do feel passive in that ideas come to me, rather than feeling I develop them through an effortful, intentional process. That's how many of my insights arise, usually aided by the reduction of a thought to a graphic representation, like those I made in China. That's just how my mind works. Back when I first arrived at the explanation of success, stated above, by the word timing, I had meant lucky timing. After all, what could be better than being aggressive at a fortuitous time? But lying in bed in India, I noted that good timing doesn't have to be exclusively the result of luck. Rather, good timing in investing can come from diligently assessing where we are in a cycle and then doing the right thing as a result. The study of cycles is really about how to position your portfolio for the possible outcomes that lie ahead. That, in one sentence, is what this book is about. I'd like to return to that simple sentence and apply a little more thought regarding the formula for investment success. I conclude that it should be considered in terms of 6 main components, or rather, 3 pairings. Cycle positioning. The process of deciding on the risk posture of your portfolio in response to your judgments regarding the principal cycles. Asset selection. The process of deciding which markets, market niches, and specific securities or assets to overweight and underweight. Positioning and selection are the 2 main tools in portfolio management. It may be an oversimplification, but I think everything investors do falls under one or the other of these headings. Aggressiveness. The assumption of increased risk. Risking more of your capital. Holding lower quality assets. Making investments that are more reliant on favorable macro outcomes. And/or employing financial leverage or high beta, market-sensitive assets and strategies. Defensiveness. The reduction of risk. Investing less capital and holding cash instead, emphasizing safer assets, buying things that can do relatively well, even in the absence of prosperity, and/or shunning leverage and beta. The choice between aggressiveness and defensiveness is the principal dimension in which investors position portfolios in response to where they think they stand in the cycles and what that implies for future market developments. Skill. The ability to make these decisions correctly on balance, although certainly not in every case, through a repeatable intellectual process and on the basis of reasonable assumptions regarding the future. Nowadays, this has come to be known by its academic name, alpha. Luck. What happens on the many occasions when skill and reasonable assumptions prove to be of no avail? That is, when randomness has more effect on events than do rational processes, whether resulting in lucky breaks or tough luck. Skill and luck are the prime elements that determine the success of portfolio management decisions. Without skill on an investor's part, decisions shouldn't be expected to produce success. In fact, there's something called negative skill, and for people who are saddled with it, flipping a coin or abstaining from decisions would lead to better results. And luck is the wild card. It can make good decisions fail and bad ones succeed, but mostly in the short run. In the long run, it's reasonable to expect skill to win out. Part of my Indian awakening, stemming from my ruminations in China, concerned the dichotomy between selection and positioning, and the way that skill influences the outcome of those two pursuits. A market will do what it will do. Some of the outcome will be the result of economic events and corporate profitability. Some will be determined by investor psychology and the resulting behavior. And some will be determined by randomness or luck. We may have some ideas about what the future will bring in terms of market performance. They may be based on sound or defective reasoning, and they may prove to be right or wrong. But let's take the market's future performance, whatever it will be, whether knowable or not, as the starting point for our discussion here. Let's express the usual expectation for a market's behavior as a probability distribution. This is the starting point, or baseline, the canvas, if you will, for an investor's actions. The question is whether he has the skill required to improve on the market's performance through active decision-making, or whether he should give up on doing so and instead invest passively, settling for market performance. I mentioned above the two main ways in which an investor can add to returns: cycle positioning and asset selection. I'll start by going into great depth regarding the first. As I also said, I believe cycle positioning primarily consists of choosing between aggressiveness and defensiveness, increasing and decreasing exposure to market movements. Let's say you conclude you're in a propitious environment. The economic and profit cycle are on the rise, and/or likely to meet or exceed people's expectations. Investor psychology and attitudes toward risk are depressed, or at least sober, rather than feverish, and thus, asset prices are moderate to low relative to intrinsic value. In such a case, aggressiveness is called for. So you increase your commitments and add to your portfolio's risk posture and beta, market sensitivity. You have increased your potential for gains if the market does well, and for losses if it does poorly. If your judgments are validated by a market rise, your aggressively positioned portfolio, with its enhanced market sensitivity, will rise even more, making you an outperformer. The recipe for success here consists of A, thoughtful analysis of where the market stands in its cycle, B, a resulting increase in aggressiveness, and C, being proved right. These things can be summed up as skill, or alpha, at cycle positioning. Of course, being proved right isn't fully a matter within anyone's control, in particular because of the degree to which it is subject to randomness. So being proved right won't happen every time, even to skillful investors who reason things out well. On the other hand, your analysis might tell you the cycle positioning is poor, the economy is tiring, psychology is excessively optimistic, and thus so are asset prices, meaning you should tend toward defensiveness. In that case, you should take some capital off the table, and otherwise cut your risk. Now you've cut your beta and prepared for bad times. If you're right about the cycle, the market's performance will be drawn from the left-hand side of the probability distribution, and your defensive positioning will make you an outperformer in that market, losing less. Your portfolio, being defensive, is less exposed to market movements, and thus, right for a weak market. Of course, not everyone has a superior understanding of cycles. Thus, not all efforts at positioning are successful. Suppose an investor who lacks skill regarding positioning decides to turn defensive and cuts his market exposure. If the market surprises on the upside, he turns out to be wrong, and his investments underperform. In the first chapter, I introduced the subject of tendencies. The outlook for the market should be considered via a probability distribution, and that distribution, if constructed accurately, will give you a sense for its likely tendency. The market's movement through the cycle repositions the distribution, and thus influences its likely future tendency. When the market is low in its cycle, gains are more likely than usual, and losses are less likely. The reverse is true when the market is high in its cycle. Positioning moves, based on where you believe the market stands in its cycle, amount to trying to better prepare your portfolio for the events that lie ahead. While you can always be unlucky regarding the relationship between what logically should happen and what actually does happen, good positioning decisions can increase the chance that the market's tendency, and thus the chance for outperformance, will be on your side. In 1977, New York City experienced a wave of Lover's Lane murders perpetrated by a serial killer labeled the Son of Sam. In 2014, I read the obituary of Timothy Dowd, the detective who caught him. I loved the part where it quoted him as saying it was his job to prepare to be lucky. Given my view of the future as indeterminate and subject to considerable randomness, I think that's a great way to think about it. While it may sound like I'm advocating being passive and leaving things to chance, the truth is that superior investors have favorably skewed distributions of outcomes, but not batting averages of 1,000. They still need favorable outcomes. They need the right tickets to be drawn from the bowl. One of the best ways to enjoy the skewed distribution of outcomes that marks superior investors is to get the market's tendency on your side. The outcome will never be under your control. But if you invest when the market's tendency is biased toward favorable, you'll have the wind at your back. And if the tendency is biased toward unfavorable, the reverse will be true. Skillful analysis of cycles can give you a better-than-average understanding of the market's likely tendency and thus enable you to improve your chances of properly positioning your portfolio for what lies ahead. What follows is completely unrelated to the subject of cycles. So, if that's all you're interested in, you needn't read it. But I want to complete the discussion of the actions investors can take to improve performance by covering the other component of portfolio management, asset selection. Asset selection consists of identifying markets, market sectors, and individual assets that will do better or worse than the rest, and over- and underweighting them in portfolios. The higher an asset's price is relative to its intrinsic value, the less well it should be expected to do, all other things being equal, and vice versa. The key prerequisite for superior performance in this regard is above-average insight into the asset's intrinsic value, the likely future changes in that value, and the relationship between its intrinsic value and its current market price. All investors who follow a given asset have, or should have, opinions regarding its intrinsic value. The market price of the asset reflects the consensus of those opinions, meaning investors collectively have set the price. That's where buyers and sellers agree to transact. The buyers buy because they think it's a smart investment at the current price, and the sellers sell because they think it's fully priced or overpriced there. What do we know about the accuracy of those views? Theoretical. The efficient market hypothesis states that all available information is incorporated into prices efficiently so that the prices of assets are fair and investors can't beat the market by choosing among them. Logical. What we're talking about is the ability to make those judgments better than the average investor and thus achieve above-average performance. Yet the one thing we know for sure is that, on average, all investors are average. Thus, logic tells us they can't all make above-average judgments. Empirical. Performance studies show that very few investors are consistently more right than others about those judgments. Most investors do worse than the markets, especially after the subtraction of transaction costs, management fees, and expenses. That's the reason for the rising popularity of passive index investing. That's not to say no one beats the market. Lots of people do so every year, but usually no more than would be the case under an assumption of randomness. A few do it more consistently than randomness would suggest, and some of those become famous. The essential ingredient, superior insight into intrinsic value, is what gives them that ability. I call it second-level thinking, the ability to think differently from the consensus and better. I'm not going to go any further regarding intrinsic value, the relationship of price to value, or second-level thinking, since they're all covered at length in The Most Important Thing. But the bottom line is that the superior investor, who's capable of second-level thinking, is able to pick more outperforming assets than underperformers, and thus to invest more in the former and less in the latter. The recipe for superior asset selection is that simple. And what is the hallmark of that superiority? Asymmetrical results. The investor who has no skill at selection has the same ratio of winners to losers as the market. Thus, he does well when the market does well, and poorly when it does poorly. An investor with negative skill at selection picks proportionally more losers than winners, and thus does worse than the market, both when it goes up and when it goes down. In other words, his probability distribution is shifted to the left of the markets. But the skillful selector has a better ratio of winners to losers than the market. He is able to invest more in his winners than his losers, and his winners are more successful than his losers are unsuccessful. The holdings of a habitually aggressive investor who is capable of superior selection will go up more than the market when the market goes up, and may go down more than the market when it goes down. But his margin of superiority on the upside will exceed his degree of inferiority on the downside, as it comes from his ability to select assets that deliver upside potential without entailing commensurate downside risk. As a result, he'll do better than the market when it goes up, but not as badly when the market goes down, as his aggressiveness would suggest. That's an example of the asymmetry that marks the superior investor. Likewise, the habitually defensive investor with superior selection skills will do better than the market when it goes down, but his skill at selection will keep him from underperforming in rising markets to the full extent that his defensiveness alone would suggest. His skill at asset selection enables him to find defensive assets that have upside participation that is disproportionate to their downside risk. It gives him an asymmetrical distribution as well. Both of the investors with superior selection skill, the aggressive one and the defensive one, exhibit asymmetry relative to the market. That is, they both have performance distributions that are biased favorably. Both have upside potential that is disproportional to their downside risk, although in different ways. That's how alpha in asset selection manifests itself. Finally, the investor who is neither habitually aggressive nor habitually defensive, but who possesses skill at both cycle positioning and asset selection, correctly adjusts market exposure at the right time and has the asymmetrical performance that comes from a better-than-average ratio of winners to losers. This is the best of all worlds. Almost anyone can make money when the market rises and lose money when it falls. And almost anyone can have the same ratio of winners to losers as the market overall. It takes superior skill to improve in those regards and to produce the asymmetry that marks the superior investor. Please note that in this discussion, I have separated skill at cycle positioning from skill at asset selection. This bifurcation is somewhat artificial. I do it to describe the two elements that influence performance, but many great investors have both, and most of the rest have neither. Investors who are capable of both have a better sense for the market's likely tendency and can put together portfolios that are better suited for the market environment that likely lies ahead in terms of the ratio of winners to losers. That's what makes them great and rare. My epiphany in India taught me that successfully positioning a portfolio for the market movements that lie ahead is dependent on what you do, turning aggressive or defensive, and when you do it, based on a superior understanding of what cycles imply for future market moves. It's the goal of this book to help in those regards. Chapter 15. Limits on Coping. In my opinion, it's entirely reasonable to try to improve long-term investment results by altering positions on the basis of an understanding of the market cycle. But it's essential that you also understand the limitations, as well as the skills that are required, and how difficult it is. I undertook to write this book to give myself